Okay, welcome to another edition of the Skull Sessions podcast. This is your host, Dan Hank, and today my guest is David Levine. Is that how I say your name?
Yep, David Levine, yep.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what you got going on, David.
Okay, well, I have a new novel coming out. It is my fourth novel. It's called The Kuiper Belt Job, and it's coming out on November 7th.
Okay. And you said it's your fourth novel. When did you start writing?
Well, that's a very interesting question for me because
well, I mean, it's like very subjective. People, yeah.
But like a lot of people, I've been writing fiction for my whole life. I did write some stories in high school and college, and people were saying, hey, you know, you should try and get published. And I said, that sounds great. But then when I graduated from college, my first job out of college was a technical writer. And I worked as a technical writer for 20 years. And during that entire time, I couldn't write a lick of fiction. It was just too much like the day job.
What was it? You say technical writer? What was that, for a large corporation or like a...
I worked for Tektronix and for Intel and for McAfee, the antivirus company.
Okay.
And so during that time, I was writing user manuals. I was writing a lot of manuals for programmers. I wrote installation instructions. All those little things that you get with your software project and then you throw it away. I mean, these days they don't even ship documentation; it's all online.
I know McAfee, like, they force themselves on you. I'm like, no, I want to use somebody else. But go ahead, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, well, the documentation people and the marketing people are always at odds, because the documentation people want to teach you how to use the product, and the marketing people want you to push the users to do something specific. And I said, no, our job is to make it so that the users know how to use the product. Right. I was writing all these, you know, instructions and manuals and stuff, and writing fiction was just too much like a day job, and I couldn't do it at all. So I spent 20 years working on just the mechanics of writing, just you know how to put sentences together and the grammar and the punctuation, and working with editors and using outlines and managing my time. So I got a lot of education in the mechanics of putting words on the page, but nothing about characters and plots and all that stuff. In about 97, I changed careers from technical writing to software engineering. Basically, the job of the technical writer is to explain to the users how to use that crappy user interface that the software engineers made. And so I got tired of trying to clean up the mess that the engineers had made. I said, I could do this. I've got the skills. So I talked one of my managers into hiring me as a software engineer. So I started making the crappy user interfaces myself instead of having to just document them. And of course, you know, my idea was that I was going to make them less crappy. So I stopped being a technical writer. I started being a software engineer. And even though I was sitting and typing all day in, you know, the same desk, same computer, it was using a different part of my brain. And I suddenly started to be able to write fiction again. So here I was in my 40s. I was 46. And suddenly I started being able to write fiction again. So I went to Clarion West Writers Workshop in 2000. And that was where I really started to make a name for myself as a writer. So I started selling science fiction to professional markets in 2000. So that's when I really started writing. And then I did short fiction for at least 10 years before I started thinking about writing a novel. I started writing my first novel in about 2014, 2015.
Was it a short fiction? They were in like magazines, like were they in compilation books or short stories? What was going on with that?
All of the above. I've sold over 50 short stories in my career. I started in 2000, so it was print magazines. I remember I was explaining to one of my software engineer colleagues. I said, so you write these science fiction stories, and then how do you submit them? And I go, well, you print it out on 8.5 by 11 paper in monospace font, double spaced. And he said, you're shitting me. I said, I shit you not. You know, so 2000, if you wanted to submit a science fiction short story to a science fiction magazine, you had to print it out in a very specific format and put it in an envelope. That's how things were done in 2000.
What magazines were on the scene? Because I remember I applied to do, I went to art school and I was going to do originally book covers and magazine covers. And I remember the only two sci-fi magazines I saw were Analog and Isaac Asimov.
Yeah, Analog, Asimov's, and the other one was Fantasy and Science Fiction.
Okay.
All of which are still, you know, still in existence. It's precarious. The magazine business has never been particularly stable, and even less so now. And of course, a lot of the print magazines are available online, and they're selling a lot of their copies online.
Although I'm sure they're getting way less money doing that. That yeah. Seems to be the way things go. Yeah.
And also, Amazon was a major magazine distributor up until like a couple of months ago, when they decided that distributing electronic magazines wasn't a business they wanted to be in anymore. So suddenly all.
Why was that? What happened there?
Was Amazon. Amazon does what they want. They're a monopoly. They can get away with whatever they want.
It's Jeff Bezos, yeah.
So basically, Clark's World and Lightspeed and FNSF and Asimov's and Analog are all, you know, they were all selling subscriptions through Analog. Through Amazon. And Amazon said, nope, we're not going to do that anymore. And the thing is that the subscribers subscribed to Amazon. The magazines do not all they do is they get their money from Amazon.
Oh, so they got really screwed. Yeah,
totally screwed. Yeah. So they lost like 75% of their subscribers like that when Amazon turned off the spigot, and there's nothing they can do. They have no way of contacting those subscribers. And if Amazon didn't choose, basically Amazon completely controlled the messaging about what happened when those subscriptions got turned off. So the magazines have no way of contacting their former subscribers. So they all, you know, the magazines are all just really screwed by this change. And you know, this is what Amazon does. Amazon is a monopoly in behavior.
Wow, I write for a couple of magazines, and one of the magazines I write for, they stopped publishing like 4 months ago. I wonder if that's why. Like they say it's on hold, they're having problems. You know, it's not like they went under, but I wonder. I don't know all the mechanics of it. I just know that they're on hold.
Well, magazines is one of those businesses where, yeah, the joke is, you know, how do you make a small fortune? You know, how do you make a small fortune in magazines? Start with a large fortune. That's how. You know, that's the way things are. So So starting in 2000, I was selling. There were magazines, there were anthologies, and we use the term. I like to use the term anthology, meaning a book containing short stories by multiple authors, whereas a collection is a book containing short stories by one author.
Okay.
So I sold to a lot of anthologies, a lot of magazines, a lot of websites. There are some weird places to sell short stories. I actually sold a couple of short stories to a coffee company that was printing very short stories on the back of bags of beans.
Wow.
I mean, you know, if you're in the short story biz, there's lots of information about where you can sell them. And of course, there are plenty of places that will happily print your short stories and not pay you. I try to avoid those myself.
You get so much publicity. No, I'm sure you can pay real publicity, right?
Yeah. Well, you know what they say, you can die of exposure. So after writing and publishing short stories for 10, 15 years, I sold the fourth one that I wrote. This is fairly typical, actually. Many people, there's short story writers and there's novel writers, and some people are just kind of constitutionally suited for one or the other. Some people can do both. I know an awful lot of natural novelists. And so if you're out there listening to this and you find yourself writing novels and you think, gosh, I should try and write short stories, and you just struggle and struggle and struggle and can't do it, you know, just be aware that some people can't write short. You know, I know so many people that are like, every time I think I have a short story idea and I start writing it, pretty soon it balloons into novel length. I happen to be.
Well, it seems like back in the day, it was like, you know, people who wrote short stories were kind of pressuring to like be a real writer, write a novel. And some people are just suited for short stories. Like, I would say Clive Barker is way better at short stories than he is at full novels.
Yeah. Yeah. I find that Gene Wolfe also, Gene Wolfe writes short stories and novels, and it's like two completely different things. Same for George R. R. Martin also.
Right.
And the thing is, when I started writing in 2000, a lot of my ideas about what the writing business was like had been formed from reading my dad's old pulps. My dad was a science fiction fan back in the 50s and 40s.
The whole amazing stories and all that.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, amazing eventually became analog, but all those old pulps and old paperbacks. And I read the introductions and I read the nonfiction around the fiction. And so I got an idea of what the writing business was like. So when I started writing in 2000, I had an idea about what the writing business was like. That was already obsolete then and is still more obsolete now, which is that you start off by writing and selling short stories. You make your name as a short story writer, and then you sell a novel and make it big. That wasn't true even in 2000, and it's even less true now. It's just about as easy to break in with a first novel as it is to break in with a bunch of short stories. And some people are just natural novelists, and they really, you know, you gotta go with what your strengths are. Now, I encourage people to stretch. To try out other forms than the ones that you usually do. But if you keep pushing and pushing and pushing and trying to make yourself write a kind of fiction, whether it's, you know, novels or short stories, whether it's fantasy, science fiction, horror, whatever, if you think, gosh, I ought to do X, and you try to do X and it doesn't work, then, you know, maybe listen to your heart. Maybe you listen to your heart on that one. And if it really isn't working, if it isn't bringing you joy, then don't do it. But on the other hand, you know, continuing to push against the door until it opens is one thing. Continuing to push against a brick wall is another. And you've got to decide in yourself which obstacles are worth attempting to overcome. So I wrote four novels and I sold and you know, I thought they were pretty good too. But the first three did not sell, but the fourth one did sell. And that was Arabella of Mars. It came out from Tor in 2016. And I wrote two sequels, Arabella and the Battle of Venus, and Arabella the Traitor of Mars. Those were the titles that we finally wound up using. And those came out from Tor in 2016, 2017, 2018.
This is a total aside, but did you see John Carter of Mars, the movie?
I actually, you know, I've got a writer friend who worked on, there are many, many people who have optioned, those Edgar Rice Burroughs books and attempted to turn them into movies. And she worked on at least one and possibly several of those previous projects that didn't actually wind up making it to the screen. And she has some things to say about how much they left on the table, how much of the good stuff in the books did not make it onto the screen in that movie. So although it was beautiful, it made no sense. No sense at all.
Well, I know that it made no money, too. Like, it basically blackballed the star because it made so little. It was like such a disappointment. But I enjoyed it. I thought it was like kind of well done. Like, I've seen a lot, like, some people are really strict, like, it's gotta, like, with The Shining is my favorite movie ever, but I know it's not like super faithful to the original source material, but I don't really care as long as it looks good. But, you know, that's an aside. I just want to say,
a book is a book, a movie is a movie. They're two different things. Like for example, I think that the first Harry Potter movie, one of the reasons the first Harry Potter movie could have been much better than it was. And one of the problems that it had was it was trying too hard to be faithful to the book.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas the book of The Martian was incredibly faithful to the book. And I think that that was the right choice for that movie. And also, by the way, the changes that they made to the book really improved the movie.
Oh, yeah. Probably also depends on the source material and all that sort of stuff as well.
Yeah. But okay, so anyway, so the three Arabella books came out from Tor about that'd be 6-7 years ago now for the first one. And as it happens, I just a couple of months ago got my rights back, which means that the publisher, when you're dealing with traditional publishing, the publisher will pay the writer maybe in advance, maybe not in advance, depending on your contract. And that's called an advance on royalties. So they give you, X amount of money up front. And then for every copy that they sell, they put, a certain number of pennies into your savings bank. And if that pile of pennies gets tall enough that it's more than the original advance that you got paid, then it starts overflowing and you actually get royalty checks. Okay. That's called earning out. As it happens, the Arabella books did not earn out. This is actually fairly typical for a first novel. First novels only sometimes earn out. I'm not gonna make a guess as to how frequently this happens, but there are plenty of novels which are considered a success despite the fact that they didn't earn out. Now, the huge successes, the New York Times bestsellers, the ones that you've heard of, probably did earn out their advance. The Arabella books did not earn out the advance. And there's a clause in the contract called a reversion clause, which is that if it's not selling at least X number of copies per month, then it's considered out of print. And the author can ask the publisher to give the rights back.
Does that apply to all publishers or to just like the really big publishers like Penguin or Tor?
It depends on your contract. If you sign a contract that doesn't contain a reversion clause, you've made a mistake. But there are plenty of writers out there who make mistakes when they sign their contracts. I was very fortunate to have a very good agent who made sure that I got an excellent contract.
Oh, you're lucky. I didn't have that.
No. A lot of writers do not have agents. I know a lot of writers who don't like the concept of agents even. It's one of many questions that you have to answer when you're managing your own career is, do I need an agent? Am I going to listen to my agent's advice or am I going to do something else? Sometimes you have to say, my agent is not working out for me. I need another agent. My first agent was a very nice guy, but I didn't think he was pushing me hard enough. So I fired him and found a second agent. And the process of finding it, you'd think, well, I found one agent. How hard can it be to find a second one? Yeah. It took me like years.
I believe it.
So I did indeed sell those books, and then I was watching the sales, and as always happens, a book sells the most when it first come out, and then they were going down and down and down, and so when it crossed the line of being technically out of print, then I said, okay, I want my rights back. So they very kindly gave me the rights back immediately. Now, what that means is that they took it down. So the only copies of those books that you can find right now are used copies or perhaps new copies that have been sitting on a shelf in some bookstore, since they were printed. Right. But there's no ebook. You can't get the ebook from Amazon or anywhere, because when the publisher turns off that stream, then the ebooks stop being available immediately. So right now you can't buy those books. But I recently resold the rights to a company called Open Road Media that specializes in bringing old books that didn't have as much of a chance as they should have in their first life, bringing them back for a second bite at the apple. So those are coming out in February. They're going to be new ebook editions and new ebook editions, new marketing campaign. I'm very excited about it. But right now you can't get any of my novels online because the old ones are now out of print and the new one hasn't come out yet.
Do you go in and the old ones, you revise them a little bit or do anything like different, or did you say, hey, they're very strong, just put them out as they are?
I just put them out as they are. We went through a whole process of multiple rounds of edit. In traditional publishing, typically you have three rounds of edit. There's the developmental edit where the editor works on making the characters and the plot as strong as possible. Then there's the copy edit where they focus on the grammar and the punctuation and making sure that the character's eye color remains the same all the way through.
Right.
And then the pass is called the galley proof, where you look at the final, just about to go to the press versions and make sure that all the little tiny things, like, are the line breaks in the right places, and is there like a line from a paragraph sitting all alone by itself at the bottom or top of a page. That's called a widow or an orphan. Widows are at the bottom of the page and orphans are at the top, I think. So anyway, the practice is that for a good looking book, you don't want to have one line of a paragraph on a page by itself.
Right.
So you adjust the line breaks, you adjust the page breaks. Maybe if you spot a spelling mistake at this late date, and you know, mistakes good all the way through. So there are a few other kinds of changes that might get spotted in the galleys. And then after that, it's printed. And there might possibly be a second edition where you can, you know, make a few changes, but it's a rare book that gets a second edition. There's a difference between a second edition, where you actually go through and make some changes and maybe you add a new forward or something like that, and a second printing, which is just they take the same page masters and print more copies. And if a book goes to a second printing, that's a good thing. That means that the first printing sold out.
Okay, but the second edition would be a whole like reformatted, reworking.
So the new edition that's coming from Open Road, we're going to go through the whole process again, but because it's been through the book has already been through all of these different stages of editing. I'm happy with it, and the publisher is happy with it. So we're just going to go ahead and print it as it is. I've got the same final files that I sent to the publisher. Those same final files are going to be sent to the new publisher. So not making any changes to it this time, although we'll get new covers. Looking forward to seeing those, because the covers, the rights to the covers belong to the publisher, not to the author.
Oh, I guess they have either an in-house artist or like someone they hired to produce them, and said they own the rights to that. They paid for it.
I don't think even the biggest publishers have in-house cover artists anymore. There's so many very talented contract artists out there that the publishers have ongoing relationships with the big name artists that you might have heard of, but they're still
the Donato Giancola and stuff like that.
Yeah, that kind of people. Yeah, I want to say Frank Fazetta, although I don't know if he's even still working anymore.
Oh, no, he's dead. But Frank Fazetta is one of the guys that I looked up to. Like, I went to art school, and he was, like, one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, very, very talented guy. Although you can see his ego on the page. He was very proud of his body, and he put his own body in an awful lot of his works.
Right, but he had that like classic Hollywood look to it, so you know, I don't think it tracks from it at all.
No, he worked hard on that body, and he worked hard on his art. He was a very hardworking, very professional artist.
Right. No, I love his stuff. Seems so alive, so fluid. Like there are a lot of people, I'm not going to call anyone out, but there are a lot of people that kind of do his style, but looks very stiff compared to what he did. But I don't know, focusing on him all day. I mean, it's, you know, this podcast is about you. It's not about individual artists. But so what books are you going to have out? I know you said like none of your stuff is available right now, but tell me.
Okay. So if you go to my website, daviddlevine.com, I had to put I had to put my middle initial in there because David Levine is a really common name. So if you go to daviddlevine.com, you'll see I've got information on all of my published works, short stories and novels, a good 20 or 30 of my short stories are available for free online, either in text or in podcast form. There's links on my webpage to all the free fiction that's available. So if you want to read my stuff, my website. But right now all of my novels are out of print. Now my Nuba novel, The Kuiper Belt Job, comes out in November. And that'll be available in print and ebook from all the usual places. It's a small press, but they have distribution to all the major vendors. So you should be able to find it. If you're fortunate enough to have a brick and mortar bookstore, you should be able to find it there, or you can order it. Otherwise you can order it from all the ebook platforms. The ebook pre-order links aren't up yet, but I'm promised that they will be up by Monday. And so, yeah, so that book is, so the Arabella books are, they take place in an alternate regency period in the 1800s. So it's basically the Napoleonic Wars in space. It takes place in a universe where the sky is full of air and you can get to Mars and Venus on a sailing ship. And I worked out all the physics of how that could be done. And then the new
book, this involve the human species or is it like a different species?
Oh yeah, no, they're people. And the thing is, it's an alternate history. So there is a Napoleon. You know, there is a Napoleon. There is a Lord Nelson. There is a Prince Regent. All of the historical personages are also existing in this universe. And so it's an alternate history, except there's kind of two hinge, you know, the alternate histories have what you might call a hinge point, where history was going along the same as it was in our universe and then it changed.
Right.
So the hinge point in the Arabella books is where Isaac Newton, instead of seeing an apple fall from the tree, he saw bubbles rising in his bath. And so he came up with the principle of universal buoyancy. And that's why ballooning got big in the 1600s.
Oh, yeah, that's clever. Yeah, I know there's kind of like, I'm big into like the hard science stuff. And I know that, you know, there's a theory that like, they're like when people have divergences, like, you know, like Isaac Newton might see an apple fall or he might see bubbles where it diverges into another dimension. So like you have parallel dimensions running alongside each other where each one develops slightly differently, but it's almost the same people, just like slight differences.
Right. Yeah. So this world has the same history as our world up until that point, but we still have all the same major players, you know, Napoleon and the Prime Minister and all that. But the other hinge point in this universe takes place way back at the beginning of time, because this is a universe with different physics. This is a universe where the sky is full of air.
Oh, wow. Okay.
The people of the world have not figured this out yet, but I've got it figured out. I think that there actually is vacuum between the stars, but the solar system is full of air, and so there's air currents. So the heat of the sun is driving these air currents that ships can sail along to get from one planet to another. So you don't just sail straight from one planet to another. You have to follow the winds, the trade winds, as it were. I got it all worked out.
I think it was Neil deGrasse Tyson that was talking about, like, you know, how strange it is that, like, whenever they create alien creatures and then come to Earth, like, all of a sudden our atmosphere is good for them. It's like there's so much that would be like, and he also said they're also humanoid. It's like, you know, people are trying to anthropomorphize stuff, but
yeah,
you know. That's neither here nor there. I'm just saying, like, you know, people, it's strange the way people like construct things.
Yeah. Well, a lot of the aliens that we have are constrained by special effects technology. They true. Say that in Star Trek, humans have the smallest heads in the universe. in the Star Trek universe, looks like human beings with something stuck on their head, right?
Right.
Okay. So I have aliens. And the thing is, because the Arabella books are harking back to an older kind of an Edgar Rice Burroughs version of science fiction.
Yeah, no, it sounds like that. It sounds like you're kind of like, actually that's my favorite era, because it feels like modern is like flash, bang, pow, in your face, but didn't have as much backstory, you know, as like some of the more classic things did.
Yeah, and that's what kind of science fiction those are. So I've got crab-like Martians and frog-like Venusians. It's kind of harking back to the 1800s and also to the 30s and 40s, the pulp stuff. The new book, The Kuiper Belt Job, has got a more modern feel to it. Do you know The Expanse?
Yes, I watched the whole thing. Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah. Okay, and so basically, The Kuiper Belt Job is a caper novel. It's a heist caper. Criminals sticking it to the man and getting away with it. Kind of a found family thing in a universe like the universe of The Expanse. So it's a It's a hard science fiction universe where humanity has spread across the solar system, but there's no fast and light drive. So humanity is limited to the solar system, but the solar system is still a pretty big place.
It sounds a little bit like, have you seen Firefly?
Exactly. It is Firefly, Expanse, Leverage, Ocean's 11. It's basically Ocean's 11 meets The Expanse, or possibly Firefly meets Leverage. It's all about found family. It's all about a group of outcasts, misfits, rogues, thieves, con artists, making their way in a science fiction universe club. Like that of The Expanse.
Strange. So it's a hard science fiction
Max, universe, the muscle, but the story Damian, is about the people. Pilot. The story Alicia, is about a group thief, of Ty, rogues, hacker, outcasts, Shweta, criminals,
the grifter,
trying to make their way in a world that's dominated by corporations.
They would break into banks,
so it's very much a Firefly feel.
Is space more vacuum and less like filled with air, basically?
Yep. No, we got real physics in there. no crab like Martians, no sky sailing ships. The Expanse uses an unreasonably fast, slower than light drive. I also have an unreasonably fast, slower than light drive. Because with 21st century space drive technology, it's going to take a long, long time to get from one planet to another. And that makes for a novel.
I do know a lot of physicists like Michio Kaku and Lawrence Krauss said that The Expanse was the most realistic, space adventure they'd seen. So I'm sure they did everything perfect, but
the books were absolutely spot on. The TV show was mostly spot on.
is it a little more explanation in the books?
Well, the TV show worked so hard you can't shoot every shot in zero gravity using all the, all the wire work and the CGI that you would need to show it. It's just too expensive. So they made a lot more use of magnetic boots in the TV show. That they did do some shots in zero gravity that were really effective, but most of the time, obviously, you have actors walking around on a sound stage in one gravity, and so they would add. So the actors were in one gravity, but the characters were in zero G. So they would just add these little click sound effects, to remind you that the actors are sticking to the floor with their magnetic boots. And I remember there was this one shot. They were so close. There was a character walking down a hallway with her magnetic boots going click 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 click, and then she shrugs the bag off her shoulder, and you hear it hit the floor with a thud. It's like. somebody said maybe the bag was full of magnetic boots.
I don't know. Remember, there was in Game of Thrones, he left a Starbucks cup on the table. One of those like gaffes,
Yeah. Well, in Game of Thrones, the problem that they had was in the openings in the first few seasons, they really paid attention to the fact that the continent of Westeros is really big. Like, many days travel on a fast horse, and much longer if you're traveling by caravan or something. So the first couple of seasons of Game of Thrones, the fact that it took a long time to get from one place to another was an important part of the plot. And in the later seasons, when they got past the books that George R. R. Martin had written, they just kind of forgot about that. And they had characters.
That's when it all went downhill. They nuked the fridge.
That was part of it. That was, to me, a part of the way that it went downhill, in that the producers just forgot about some of that important stuff about you need to factor in the fact that it takes a long time to get from one place to another. So you had characters effectively teleporting back and forth, but there were a lot of problems with that show in the last couple of seasons. I was so disappointed.
It was the best show for the longest time. Then all of a sudden, it just like boom, it like things like the wall that were built up for episode after episode and season after season. Then one episode, boom, it's done.
Yep. The White Walkers were just okay. We'll stab one of them, and then they all go.
I was gonna ask with The Expanse, with the people that created the original wormholes, the race that died out, the advanced race, do they explain that a little bit more in the books, like where they came from or who they are or anything like that?
Not to my knowledge, no.
Okay.
It's a big mystery.
Everybody always wants more. Whenever I read anything, people are like, but where does this go? Where does that go? It's like, you know, you're going to over-explain if you put everything in there. And actually, a little bit of mystery is kind of good.
Yeah, and you look at the fandom of any universe, you know, Star Trek, Star Wars, anything like that, and there are always going to be people who are saying, gosh, they should have explained this, they should have explained that. But if they explain everything, then it becomes just an explanation and not fiction. So that's no.
Well, it's not as good because like what you make up in your head is a what if is always better than, well, not always, but like is often better than, you know, if they spell everything on, you go, ah, that's what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes the mystery is better. Sometimes the unopened mystery box is more fun.
Right.
But I do think you owe the audience answers to some of your questions. I was disappointed with the ending of Lost. I was disappointed with the ending of Galactica because they kept saying every single episode, they said the Silence had a plan. They had no plan. They were totally improvising it.
I love Battlestar Galactica. You're right. I felt like it kind of trailed off in that last season, you know, but I loved it. Like, especially the beginning of it, I was like, wow, this is so good.
Yeah. And I gotta say, you know, as a writer, I recognize that endings are really hard. Coming up with an ending that ties up enough of the loose ends in a satisfying way it's really difficult. And it's,
I mean, look at Stephen King. That's like the biggest complaint people have about some of his work.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember, what was that one that took place under the dome? I think it was called the Under the Dome. Yeah. And we never got an explanation. That was endings are hard. I mean, look at Monty Python. You know, Monty Python sent a sketch to save their lives. So endings are hard. And I can't start writing. I can't start writing a story or a novel until I have an ending in mind. I might possibly wind up in a different place than I started, but I have to have somewhere that I'm heading before I can even start moving.
Right. Okay. All right, so do you, I know you got to go pretty soon, so I'm not going to keep you here much longer, but do you have like kind of a structure that you work out, like a storyline that you want to follow? Like some people tell me I didn't even know this when I started doing the podcast, they're what's called pantsers, like they write by the seat of their pants, you know, and some people like lay out like Alan Moore, or like Richard Matheson, you know, they kind of lay everything out and they kind of go with that. They change the elements.
Moore. Yeah. Alan Moore, you know, you look at his scripts, he's got it plotted out panel by panel, you know. Of the comic book that he's writing. So generally speaking, writers divide themselves into plotters and pantsers. Do you plan everything out or do you fly by the seat of your pants? And I've always been a plotter, but I'm finding that as I become more experienced, I do write an outline, but the outline points are farther and farther apart. So I'm improvising longer and longer stretches between the plot points. So I was like writing detailed outlines for a short story. And these days I can write a short story with just sort of a generalized, okay, these are the five things that happen. So I'm becoming more of a pantser, but a more polite term for a pantser is a discovery writer. Somebody through the process of writing it. And I'm definitely becoming more of a discovery writer as I become more experienced at this whole writing thing.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, maybe you don't need to plot it out as much because you kind of have, like, the basis of it in the back of your head. You know, you come up with elements, you're like, I know how they fit in the pattern.
Yeah, that is exactly how I work, that I am. My process is that I start off writing notes to myself. I'm just kind of talking out loud on paper, as it were, just saying, well, what if this happened? Well, how about that? Well, okay, so if we have this, then what's that next thing that happens? And so I do a lot of, I call it noodling. I will noodle for a long time on a story before I even have an outline, and then I'll noodle a little bit more once I have an outline to figure out, okay, fill out some of the details, and then I start drafting. And I'll draft for a while, and then I'll hit a point where I need to make a decision. Then I'll go back and noodle for a while, and then I'll go back and drafting. I almost always write my drafts through from beginning to end. I'm not one of those people who can just sort of write a scene and then write what comes before that, and then maybe come back and write things out of order. Usually, I will create a story in order, even a novel. I'll start writing at the beginning and go all the way through to the end. And I might possibly move some things around, but that's really tough, actually. I describe, if you're trying to move a scene from one part of the book to another, it's like taking a piece of sky in a jigsaw puzzle and moving it to a different place in the sky. And when you do that, you discover that, well, the pieces, even if it's approximately the same shape, it's going to be a different shape. So you have to kind of like file it and glue bits on. And then you kind of cram it into the hole. And you discover that even though they're both blue sky, it's a slightly different shade of blue, or maybe there are brush strokes. So you need to have to do, yeah, it obviously seems to me that
and you have to go and rework previous material to try and make it, you know, jive with like the new material, and then like it some feels stiff, and yeah.
So I find that moving something to a different place in the book, it's often easier to just delete it and write fresh. I hate to waste work. And so I will put a lot of effort into saving even a paragraph or a sentence, if I particularly like it. I will do the work to make it fit into a new place. Something that I often find myself doing is I will take a scene that's from one character's point of view, and for a variety of reasons, it seems to make sense to have that same scene written from a different point of view. And I find it fascinating to see how a scene changes when you move it from one character's POV to another. Because when I'm writing a description of anything, if you're describing a thing, then you have, of course, you have the description of the thing. You know, this is what the thing looks like, or what it feels like, or what it tastes like, depending on what you're describing. But also, you're doing character development on the character that's observing it. What is important to that character? What's the first thing that they notice? What's something that they don't notice at all? What's important to them? What are the things that stick out to them? So if I have two different characters describing exactly the same object, you're going to get very different perspectives from the two characters' point of view. Like, for example, you have a character, I've done this. You have a character walk into a party. Okay. And the character looks around and it's like, oh, okay, there's Lord so-and-so talking to Lady thus and such. Oh, what are they plotting together? And then, oh my God, I can't believe that dress that she's wearing. That is like last season. I can't imagine why she's wearing that dress. You have another character walk into the same party and it's like, okay, so the spy cameras are there, there, and there. He's packing, she's packing. That is somebody I need to keep an eye on because I do not like his stance. Okay. Two different characters, same party, completely different perspective. They see different things. And so when you do that, you're not only describing the party, but you're describing the character. And also you're doing world building. Like that second character, when he notices he's packing, she's packing. Well, this is a world in which there is such a thing as a concealed weapon. You know,
you're making the backstory more comprehensive.
Yeah, if this is a world of broadswords, you don't have that concept of packing. You know, a broadsword, carrying a broadsword means something very different in a world of broadswords than carrying a concealed gun does in a world of concealed guns, right?
Right.
So these two descriptions tell you not only about the party, but about the character and about the world in which it takes place. So, and this is something that I learned from short fiction writing, where every word has to do double and triple duty because you have so few of them to play with. So I've carried a lot of these skills forward to novels. And I think that my novels are better for it.
Okay. All right. Like I said, I knew you had to go, but I have a couple more questions for you real quick.
Yeah. No, I can go another 15-20 minutes, no problem.
I noticed, because I interview a wide variety of people, and I noticed that some people, like especially indie writers and people that only have like a couple years in the game, they tend to go more for first person. And it used to be, I mean, one of my favorite authors ever is H.P. Lovecraft, and I know he is first person, but a lot of publishers kind of look down on the first person perspective. What's your take on that?
When these things go, there are trends that there are trends and tastes that change. And the preference for first or third is something that has changed back and forth a number of times over the past couple of hundred years that we've been writing novels in English. So when I was first getting into short fiction, back in the 20th century, third person past tense was considered kind of the default. I was writing a lot of stuff in first person present because it felt more immediate, but I learned...
Yeah, that's another thing I was to ask you about, past tense versus present tense.
So I learned that first person present is, it feels more immediate, but it's actually really limiting because it's difficult for the character to have any kind of reflection or perspective. So you're limited to what's happening in the moment. You can't have the character step back and go, if I had that to do over again, I would have done it differently. And so I've given a lot of thought to the question of person and tense.
Well, I guess he could like contemplate on what his better course of action would have been.
Right. Yeah. In that first person present, you can do that, but it feels kind of intrusive, and it's difficult to maintain the pace of the story with those contemplative motions in there. Whereas a contemplative moment, and this is a thing that I see newer writers do a lot, is they have a character have like a flashback in the middle of a fight scene, and you can't do that while you're fighting. You are focused on the fight.
It's breaking the momentum too. Yeah.
Yeah, you can do anything in fiction. You can stick a flashback in the middle of a fight scene, but you have to do it very deliberately. And I find that flashbacks work much better if you get done with the fight and the character is, cleaning their sword or whatever. And that's when they reflect upon, my father told me that I'd end up in a bad way if I kept on like this. There's a rhythm, there are places within the narrative where you can put in the contemplative moments, and that's a lot harder in first person present.
Right.
I've done some wild stuff in the Kuiper Belt job. The Kuiper Belt job has five first person narrators, and usually when you have multiple narrators, you kind of bop back and forth between them. In the Kuiper Belt job, I'm doing what I consider kind of a stunt, but I think it works. I hope it works. We'll see what the readers think. That each of the five viewpoint characters gets a big chunk, like 20,000 words. So each of them has just one long scene on stage, and then in between those five big chunks of first person narration, that's first person past tense. There are flashbacks to when the gang was together 10 years ago, and those are in first person plural. They're in we past tense perspective. So because the idea is that 10 years ago, when the gang was all together, they were all living in each other's pockets, they were all sleeping together, they did everything together. And so there was no I, only we. So right. So the flashbacks are in we, and the present tense stuff is in I.
Yeah, no, that's clever. Yeah.
Also, you may be familiar with the concept of close and distant third person. It's like, that grammatically speaking, you can say he did X. Okay.
Right.
And so that's third person perspective. But is it like he thought that this might not be a good idea?
What's the technical name for it?
Close third person. If you say.
Oh, okay. Yeah, once you delved into it, I was like, I know what you're talking about. I just don't know the technical name for it.
Okay, let me give you an example. I'll say, so an example of close third person is he touched the doorknob, but realized that this was not the right time to do this and walked away. Okay, more distant third person is he put his hand on the door, hesitated, then turned away. So you got the same thing, but you don't know.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so there's close and distant third, and there's a whole, you know, it's not just there's only, there's not close and distance, there's a whole range of how close you can get. And it's, I think it's really important to use that deliberately. You know, you don't just bop back and forth between close and distant. You don't have...
It's confusing, yeah.
Yeah, you don't like, you know what's in the character's head in this moment, and the next moment you see him do something and you have no idea why. You know, that is frustrating for the reader. But I believe there's also close and distant first, because you can, grammatically, you can say, I put my hand on the doorknob and then I let go and turned away. That's a distant first. Whereas you can say, my hand on the doorknob, it was cold in my hand and I reflected, do I really want to be doing this thing? And then I let go of the doorknob and turned away. So that's a close first. Then you can also, you can have the analogy that I use is like, is the camera like, are you looking
at? I grabbed the doorknob or I grabbed the doorknob. So like, it's still first person, but yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. So are you looking out through the character's eyes? Is the camera like right on the character's shoulder, very close to the camera, or is the camera way back seeing the whole scene together? So that's, you know, and you talk, we use this terminology in like video games. Is it a first person or third person shooter? So, and then, and of course the only book that's written in second person is a cookbook. and I have read fiction written in first person, in second person, even second person future. It's a bit of a stunt, but it can be done. So I like to play with close and distant first. And like distant first, if you write an autobiography and you say, this is what I did when I was a young man and I made some really stupid mistakes, that's a very distant first person perspective. Right. There's value to that.
Or you can, I'm doing this would be, you know, exactly. Close.
And yeah. you can do that closer distant. A lot of people think that first person present is the way to get that closeness, but you can actually get that closeness and immediacy using grammatical past tense. And that using grammatical past tense gives you some more tools to really get the information you need across to the reader.
Okay. Yeah, no, I think there's some great tips, and I think everybody should pay attention to that, because I see a lot of people that they learn the basics and they just plow in. And I think some of those technical aspects really help. Like, I've noticed myself as a writer, you know, I started in 2010, between then and now, like I've learned and developed so much, and there's so much more to learn.
And I teach a lot of writing classes. I teach workshops at science fiction conventions. I've taught a number of classes online. I don't know, when is this podcast going live?
Whatever you want. We'll talk about that after it's over.
Okay, yeah. But it's okay, but I'm teaching a class on October 15, which is 3 days away as we speak. It's called Plot Considered as a Four-Dimensional Array of Brightly Colored Beads. And I talk about the relationship between, and these are terms that I'm using in a very specific way, not the way that they're used most of the time. I talk about the relationship of story, plot, and narrative. So I'm talking about. Okay. So anyway, so I've got a whole. I'm not going to try and do that class right now, but I do writing classes in things like integrating character, plot, and world building, or talking about using sets and props, talking about writing description. I mean, what I said just now about how every time you describe something, you're describing the character as well. Okay, so that's one of the things that I talk about. So I've given this a lot of thought, and I do have a background in teaching. I've got a bunch of technical classes online on LinkedIn Learning. So if you want to learn about the awk programming language, I'm your guy. So I've done a lot of teaching, and I like to teach about writing as well. So you may see me doing workshops either online or at a convention near you.
Okay. Is everything going to be, do you have a website? Is everything going to be on your website?
Everything. Yeah. I do keep my website up to date. It's daviddlevine.com, daviddlevine.com. So you can find links to, I've got a lot of short fiction available online for free. I've got links to where you can buy either my books. I mean, as I said before, right now, all of my books are out of print, but by February, all my novels will be back in print. So if you're listening to this anytime after February 24, go to daviddlevine.com and you can buy all four of my published novels. And if you're awesome. listening to further in the future than that, there may be more. Who knows?
All right, man. Well, thank you very much. Do you have anything else that you want to promote, or should everybody just look at what's going on your website?
Yeah, look at my website, and definitely you know anytime in the next year or so, go to your favorite bookstore and buy The Kuiper Belt Job, Kuiper. A word which, if you see it written down, you won't know how to pronounce it, and if you hear it, you won't know how to spell it. But there it is. That's the title, The Kuiper Belt Job.
Right, Kuiper with a K, right?
Kuiper, The Kuiper Belt Job. The Kuiper Belt is one of the areas of the outer solar system.
No, well, science nerds know it, but not everyone knows it.
But hopefully, you know, it's a heist story in space. So hopefully people who are not science nerds will still be able to enjoy it. And it really is, you know, really, if you like Firefly, if you like The Expanse, if you like Leverage, if you like Ocean's 11.
Everyone should like Firefly.
Yeah, no, I love it. I love Firefly. And it is very much a Firefly feel. So check it out. I hope you like it.
Okay, awesome, man. Thank you very much. Do you have anything else you want to add?
No, thank you very much for having me on.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it.